session number 16808, reel 27.
Spittles, reel 27.
And we went to this village, and the conditions, considering the chaps had come from hospitals, were diabolical. We were living in sort of garages associated to what appeared to be some form of barracks. And there were concrete floors and the old door shutters. And as I was saying, this is Christmas time in 1944. And we had no allocation for fires, and we used to go out wooding in the countryside, and we just made fires like you did when you're kids. There was no braziers or nothing like that. You just went out, collected wood, anything that would burn, and you burn them. And in these hangars, you've got this big fire going, and people used to get stuff and chuck on it, keep it going. And then, of course, at night, the war was still going on, of course, so they used to shut these doors, and the fires were still burning, and in the morning, car, you could hardly croak. The smoke and that from and the atmosphere from these fires being enclosed, you get the doors open, and your eyes were running, where your eyes had run, there was lines down your face with the smokes, the discoloration on your face from the smoke and that. And it's the most disgusting situation. I mean, if you'd have been fit men, you'd have been in bad conditions. But for men coming out of a hospital, it was diabolical. And they had these toilets there, and the continental toilets, I don't know, they must have only changed, but in those days you had the old pre-war continental toilets from like the 14 war. And when you went in, they got at least they got a door on each cubicle. And you went in, and they got a metal handle on each wall and a hole in the floor and two recesses for your feet to go in, one each side. And you did whatever you got to do by nothing to sit on. You just held onto these handles, put your feet in these recesses and did whatever you wanted to do down this hole into a communal chamber underneath. Well, once a week, they used to come to clear it out. And these two chaps used to come with the clogs on, and this horse pulling this cylinder, like a long cylinder, with a wheel at either end, and they used to just throw the top half open, and then they used to get these yokes, as they called them, the wooden yokes, where you have a chain and a hook on either end, and you hook your buckets on either end to carry two buckets at once without having to strain yourself. And they used to go down, and they opened these flaps so they could walk down these broad steps to the trough that was underneath these holes, you see. And initially, of course, it's more liquid than sludge. And so they would go down these buckets, and they'd go woof with one bucket and woof with the other one. They knew just what to do. And initially, it's just liquid. And they come clunking up with the old clothes on, drop them down, disengage the hooks, pick up two empty ones, and he'd go back down the thing. And while he's down there, the first one would empty these buckets into the cylinder, you see. And they'd put them down, and then they'd take turn about. After two or three times, the other one would do it, you see. And eventually it got down to the sludge. And they just got these big scoops and scooped it all up so they could still get it out, until they got basically 90% of it gone. There was no disinfect put down, nothing at all. And then they just shut the flaps down and went away. And because we was in the country, they used to go across the fields, and they got this pipe along the back, and it was all perforated with holes, and then they'd turn the tap on, and all the liquid would come out, and they'd walk up the horse up the field, you see, and it would sort of spray all the liquid, urine, on the ground as he walked up the field, you see. And he'd turn around, and once that stopped, then they'd bring him back to the end of the field, open the end of the cylinder and scrape out all the sludge into a big heap. And so, because it was not far away, if the wind was in the right direction, you had the smell of that coming over the barracks. Honestly, it was nothing, it was out of this world. And we was there, now I hardly spent Christmas there, but I think I'd spent it in Bruges. But I was there, for weeks and weeks went by, and they got a little cinema there. Actually, I've still got me ticket what we had to go in the cinema, and which I'd never handed in. It's in our scrapbook. Trying to think, it's got a posh little name, like a Spanish little name, and this little tiny cinema with a little balcony. And you can imagine with a place there with about 2,000 blokes in, with a cinema around about 200 people. I think I got there in there about twice all the time I was there. But anyway, a strange thing happened while I was there. I took all my badges off, you see, because you got now into an era where people were collecting. And if you went to bed at night and you left your berry lying about it, when you got up in the morning, the badge would be gone. Or if you left your jacket, tunic, all the insignias, like your divisional signs, would be nicked. People were, army people, were great pilferers they were, pinch anything they would, you know. Even in no good term, they still pinch it. And so the first thing you did was take off all your badges and everything and keep them safe. Anyway, in the village was a cafe, a restaurant, or a stamina, as they called them. And we used to go in there, you see. Now, I was a very good mouth organ player. And my father always reckoned I was as good as Larry Adler, but I wouldn't say that. Although when Larry Adler came to Northampton before the war, which he did twice at the New Theatre, each week he used to, the week he was there, he used to run a competition for local talent. And the idea was that the one that was chosen as being the best on the week, he would give him one of his mouth organs, you see. And everybody said, cool, one of Larry Adler's mouth organs, cool, you know, that was something to have. And I don't know if it was the first time or the second time, but anyway, I went in for it, because we, at that time, lots of lads used to play mouth organs, you see. And I went in for it, and I used to play a 12-hole chromatic harmonica, a Hohner chromatic harmonica. Now, the difference in a normal one that people play was 10 holes, and it only had a 1.5 octave, which meant you couldn't play a tune straight through without deviating top or bottom of the mouth organ. If you had a 12-hole, you had a full 2.5 octaves, which meant you could play a tune straight through without having to go in the high notes when you should have been in the bottom, in the low notes, because the notes weren't there, you see, on a 10-hole, but they were in a 12-hole, you see. So that gave you that advantage. The next size was a 15-hole, but it was a big cumbersome instrument, so I never went on, I kept on the 12-hole, you see. And when I went in for this thing, each night, somebody would be seen. The night I went, you see, to see him, I'd put my name down at the foyer to go in a competition, and they always had more names than they could put on the stage, so they just picked some out. And I got picked out to go, and I went on this particular night, and I won my nights. There was about 3 or 4 of us, and they said I was the best, so I was put down for the final, you see, at the end of the week. So I was invited back to the performance at the end of the week. I didn't have to pay to go in that week. It was only a tanner, but you still didn't have to pay, obviously. And Ed had, as I say, my father had been a brass bander, you see, so he knew all about music and that. He said, now I'll tell you what to play. Londonderry Air, the old Irish song. Play it simple, play it correctly, in the proper speed. No trimmings at all. Play it straight, plain and simple. Londonderry Air. Well, it's a gift as a solo for any wind instrument. So I did, I played Londonderry Air, and I won Larry Adler's mouth organ. And it was an ordinary common or garden 10-hole instrument, which I immediately sold for $5, because it was no good to me. And there was all this bull about Larry Adler's mouth organ, and it was an ordinary common or garden $5 10-hole Hohner. And I immediately sold it in the box, because these were lovely boxes I used to be in, and I won Larry Adler's thing, you see. Anyway, he came twice to Northampton, as I say. But my dad always reckoned I was as good as him on chosen the tune for it. But anyway, I was never short of, when we went out anywhere, even in England, if we went anywhere, if there was a pub, you went in a pub, someone said, get your mouth organ out, Reg. And immediately, there was beers on the table. But playing the mouth organ, I couldn't drink them. So the lads all used to say, Where are you going on? I said, well, Dennis, oh, right, well, we'll come with you, he said, because I used to play the mouth organ, people would buy me the beer, and I used to drink them, because I couldn't, you see. So it was a good gimmick. But so I played this mouth organ, and of course, I always could claim that every time a new tune came out, if I could whistle it, I could play it. It was that simple. No trouble at all, because all the half notes were there, and the chromatic, you see. So you played it like a pure musical instrument. You didn't play it like an ordinary single hole mouth organ. It was chromatic, you see. So you could play a tune correctly with all the half notes and everything, you see. And while we was there, you see, they in this place, diabolical place, one of the sergeants came over, and all the sergeants were in the barracks, you see, and the officers and all, they were in the barracks, but all the other ranks, corporals downwards, you see, were all in these garages. And one of the sergeants, he said, hey, he said, I understand you play mouth organ, mate. So I said, yeah. He said, give us a tune, will you? So I'll give a tune. And he said, God, bloody marvellous, he said. Tell you what, he said, bring your kit, he said, you can have a bed over in our place with the sergeants. Now, this is where my character comes in. Straight away, that's unfair, isn't it? That I should have to be disassociated from my ordinary people for the privilege of playing a mouth organ for them, their pleasure. I said, oh, sorry, Sarge. Hey, so, I mean, you won't go in the line for your grub, he said, you know, you'll be in a mess with us and all that. I said, no, I said, stuff it, like, you know. You might say, well, stupid, you know, but that was how my character was, you see. And so anyway, we, down this cafe we used to go, and somebody said about playing mouth, so I'll play my mouth organ, so it was great. Always there, nice, you know. And then the son there, Andre, he was talking one day, and he used to like to talk to the lads. And I said, because we're in a berry, they were in a tank regiment, so, and he said, what was you in? And I said, good, originally, I said, I was in the Northamptonshire Yeomanry. So he said, you come from Northampton? I said, yeah, I was born there. Ah, he said, I am apprentice to Mr. van der Kerkhoven in Bruges. I am his apprentice to learn bootmaking. And he wanted to know all about Northampton, you see. So anyway, this meant that instead of being in the front of the cafe, now I was in the kitchen, you see, and I could have a little meal on the side and all that, you see, little privileges. The two daughters, they all got their eye on me. Mind you, I was married, so I had to be very careful with them. And the mother kept telling them off, because they kept, you know, like a comic thing in the pictures, really. Anyway, he said, eventually I was going to get posted into Bruges, to the barracks in Bruges, you see. So he said, I'll give you a letter of introduction to my principal, my master, he called him, my master. That was Gaston, you see, who was the principal for the district. And they used to train these students. So he said, I will give you a letter of introduction, you see. So he wrote me this letter, and I went to Bruges, and immediately got in a row. And I powered up with a lad from the signals, Sid Green. Yes, so I arrived at Bruges, and like you're doing the services, you always have a friend. Total strangers, especially when you're all strangers together anyway. And I met up with this chap called Sid Green from the Royal Corps Signals, and his trouble apparently was prostate. And so whether he was going to have any hospital treatment, I don't know, but that was his problem, prostate, you see. And he'd been downgraded the same as I had. And of course, we get into the barracks at Bruges, which again was same as everything else, too many people in too small a space. I think it's supposed to have about 2,000 people, and there was about 4,000 or 5,000 of us in there. But at least we were in barrack rooms rather than hangars, which we had been at the other place. And when we arrived, our batch, we were documented, and went up to the sergeant major, took us up into the barrack blocks, walked along these corridors, you see, and as you come to each barrack room, he would open the door, look in, see if there's anybody in there, say, how many empty beds in here? Somebody say, oh, six out, you know, whatever. And he say, right, you six in here. And so he just bung you in, you see. He didn't differentiate who you were. I mean, you were just units of people, really. And, of course, I found myself in one of these rooms where there was empty beds. And you go in and naturally all the top beds are took, really, because although you might think it's better to be on the bottom bed, it was awkward because most people tended to sit on the bottom beds, even if it's not their bed. If they're on the top bed, they tended to sit a bed on the bottom bed, so it was always being how your kit sat on. Anyway, I found a bed, spare space, and sort of looked round and see who was there and who wasn't. And of course, not everybody was in the room. It depends on time of day, where people are. And so you sort of settle down and you start asking questions about naffy and comforts and rations and chocolate and cigarettes and stuff like that. And of course, what used to happen as you got organised and somebody would come and take charge, you had a card which entitled you to purchase certain items such as soap, chocolate, cigarettes and all that. And of course, they were supposed to have a store with someone in charge, like a quartermaster. And so we gets eventually sorted out a bit, and we got one of these things crop up. And as I've said before, I believe, I was a chap who always managed somehow to get into little scrapes by perhaps being too honest, I suppose, and liking things to be done fair, and not stepping back, as you might say, from an issue where a lot of people think, well, it's not worth bothering about, but I always used to think it was worth bothering about. Right, so in this instant, what cropped up, after I'd sort of settled down and got organised and chatted a bit, I said, well, what about the, you know, rations, your soap and chocolate and cigarettes and that? And one of the lads there said, you've got some oats, mate. I said, what do you mean? He said, good. He said, you got a right old racket going here, he said. And it's strange because whenever you got in these types of units, it wasn't long before people seemed to work things out for themselves, and they formed little cliches and made themselves good little sidelines, you see. So I said, what do you mean? He said, well, he said, last week all we got was such and such a thing. He said, and I mean, there's about a dozen things on the card, he said, but you never get them. He said, look, if you get a couple of them, he said, they're always promising they ain't had them come in, or you'll get them next week and all that sort of thing. He said, and we ain't had, I forget what it was now, certain items. He said, we ain't had none of them for weeks, he said. So I said, oh. So anyway, I waited until I knew who was actually in the room, the whole personnel, because there'll be about a couple of dozen of you in each room, you see. And it turned out there was another corporal in there. Well, I never knew his name. His name was Bert. That's all I knew, his name's Bert. I got a photo with Bert and another lad who was a chap from the Queens, who apparently was always getting into trouble. So sometimes he was a sergeant, sometimes he was a private, and he's an old desert man, like you see. And he was a Welshman, old Taffy. Now he was a sort of a fatherly type to Bert. Bert used to go out, get sort of three quarters cut every night, but never fighting drunk. He was always friendly drunk. He used to want to be friends with everybody. And Taffy used to just bring him home and put him to bed, and he used to sober up the next morning, he was all right. And I said, so are you in charge now, Bert? So he said, no, he said, nobody's in charge, he said. It's every man for himself here, like, you know. I said, well, you can't do that. And I said, you've got to be organised. Now, he was from the King's Own, and he was a tank man, you see. And I said, you've got to have organisation. You can't just leave it coming in and being isolated in. So not now. I said, it was all right before when we was in a hangar and about 200 blokes in each hangar, and nobody knew anybody, and there was no separation. Your kit was on the floor in a pile. But now we was in an organised room, a situation where you've got a proper bed and a cupboard. And so I said, no. I said, oh, well, he said, you better be in charge, he said. I mean, you seem to know what you're talking about. So again, as I say, I put my foot in it and found myself in charge through keeping me opening my mouth, you see. Anyway, when this issue of stuff came up, they came round, you see, and they said, well, you missed it this week because they always issue it on a certain day every week, you see. And the day we arrived, by the time like 24 hours had gone by and I'd organised myself as regards my surroundings and the people, and apparently we were too late, we would have to wait until next week, you see. So I said, well, wherever I've been, I said, as soon as you arrive, they give you your ration ticket for your the conference, as you might say, and you're automatically expected to be able to go and cash it, collect what you're due, you see. Oh, no, they don't do that here. They say you've got to wait till next week now. And they'd only had it like the day before, sort of thing. And they said, in any case, this chap said, you won't get half of it anyway. So I said, well, give me all your cards. I said, and I'll go over and see about it. And this one chap, he was definitely convinced there was nothing was ever going to be put right. And so I collected all the cards on myself. I said, you put your names on them, because they didn't have names on, you see. So you had to put your own name. So I put all the names on, and I went across. I took one of the lads with me, and I think this is where Sid came in. I mean, it must have been Sid that I took with me. And we went across and to this office where this quartermaster's place was, and went in. And of course, usually there's a lance corporal, unpaid lance corporal, who immediately sees you. And then, of course, the other people at the back who sort of, you never see the bus sort of thing. Anyway, this lance corporal came around. He said, yes, corporal, what do you want? I said, I'm coming to see about these rations. I said, well, yeah, we've arrived. I said, do I need just? I said, apparently we just missed this week's share ahead. I said, but I said, we're entitled to some of these because the dates were dated, you see. You had this card and there was all the columns week by week by week, all dated, you see. So that meant that that column would be totally void if we got nothing at all. So I said, no, I said, we're entitled to certain things. I said, so what can you supply me on these cards? No, he said, you've got to come back next week, he said, and all that. So I said, well, look, who's in charge? So he said, Sergeant so-and-so, he did say who the name was. So I said, can I see him? He said, well, it wouldn't do you any good. I said, well, it wouldn't do me any harm. I said, have a word with him. Oh, all right, he said. So, of course, he wanders off in the back somewhere, and I heard this boy say, what, telling a bugger off, he said. Come back next. He said, no, I mean, when the stuff's dished out, there's none left. So he said, well, I told him, he said, he seems pretty stubborn. All right, he said, I'll come and see him. And I could tell by his tone he's going to sort me out, you see. So he came round, and I looked, I knew him instantly. And I said, come back these rations. I said, I only got here yesterday. I said, and, you know, I said, and the other chap said that apparently they didn't get the dues. No, he said, well, in any case, he said, I mean, this week's stuff's all been dished out, he said, so, I mean, any people who come in now have missed it, he said, oh, we cater for so much staff. He said, and if they suddenly bring in an additional quantity, well, there's no facility for them, you see. So I said, no. I said, well, when we came, I said, there was about 50 blokes went out. I said, what happened? Did they have them before they went? I said, so he said, well, I couldn't tell you offhand, he said, but I suppose I would have done. I said, I suppose I wouldn't have done. I said, what a chance for you, I said, to a little bit of backstop for your black market going on in the town. I said, what do you suppose you've got? He hung on, he said, and he started getting a bit aggressive. And I was teasing him, you see, because he didn't know that I knew him. And because when I was in the yeomanry, you see, in England, we used to have personnel coming and going quite frequently, you see. And normally you don't always remember these people, but in this case I remembered him very, very vividly for a certain incident that happened. And I'll explain what it was now, before I go any deeper. And when we were at a place called Ogbourne St George, in between Swindon and Marlborough, which was a brigade camp, a permanent built camp, which was only in the last few years, I believe, knocked down or done away with. And we used to have changing personnel, and this sergeant, we used to do this guard, particular guard, and they used to draw personnel from each of the three squadrons, regimentally, so you didn't always know everybody who was on guard, did you see? And this particular night, this sergeant was guard commander, and I was NCO in charge of reliefs as a corporal. And we used to have this chap there then, and he was a right honourable someone. And every weekend, he'd have a Bentley or a Rolls or something, would come up, pick him up with a chauffeur and take him home. And he used to be on permanent weekend leaves, you see. Well, if any duties came up that he didn't like, that he didn't want to do, it was all somebody there would do it for half a crown or five bob, you see. And so when he got a guard come up, he'd say, somebody do my guard for me, so I'll give you 5 shillings, you see. And they'd do his guard, you see. Well, the guard used to be put up on the orders. And this sergeant, and this one in particular, he said, when he knew about it, he said, well, he'll be doing this guard, he said, if he never does another one. So, of course, when it came for this chap bringing his 5 bob out, nobody dared take it because they knew this sergeant said anybody who takes the 5 bob is going to be under charge. So he had to do his guard, you see, and which was rather crazy, really. They had to make him stick man because I don't think he knew how to handle a rifle. It was comical. But then I always remember this sergeant because of that incident, but he made that man do a guard which he'd never done before. And I always wonder what happened to him. I suppose he became an officer. But anyway, I knew him straight away, you see, but he obviously didn't immediately recognise me. And I said, well, the thing is, I said, these blokes have been shortchanged. I said, you're got a fiddle going on, obviously. And he said, hey, hang on, he said, start again. I said, no, I said, you hang on. I said, by the way, I said, I don't suppose you remember Ogborne St. George. So he said, Ogborne St. George? I said, yeah, 2nd Northampton Yeomanry. Yeah, he said, I was with them for a time. I said, yes, I said, and I was your NCO in charge of relief. So I said, when you made that bloke do his guard, I said, the Right Honourable. Oh, yes, he said. Oh, of course, that, yes, he said, that was you, wasn't it? He said, yes. So we immediately sort of became, not friends, but we became sociable, you see. So I said, yeah, I said, I've told that story numbers of times. I said, it's always been a good bait room story, that, I said. And that's your claim to fame, I said. So I said, anyway, what about these rations? I said, I mean, I'm not worried about the barracks. I said, I'm just worried about my room. I said, I'm in charge of a room. I said, and while I'm here, I said, I shall expect my room to have its quota. I said, I shan't tell everybody else in the barracks we're getting it. I said, but we won it. Hang on, he said, give us your cards, he said. And he went off and he come back with a big cardboard box full of stuff, he said. Hey, anyway, he said, you know, so he said, but don't keep stum about it, he said, you know, he said, I don't want everybody coming around here demanding the rights, he said, else I'll get nowhere. So, and I found out the longer I was there that black market in Bruges was rife. God, you could not trust anybody. You know, it was, well, the situation was that when the room in the evenings, people were going out socially, like, you'd always got to have someone in the room. At all times, there got to be someone in the room. Otherwise, you came back and after beds had been pilfered. Anyway, of course, he goes back with all this stuff and puts it in the dunes. And this chap didn't happen to be there, who was a bit, not stroppy, but a bit of an unbeliever, put it that way. So, anyway, put the box under the corner out of the way. And when they were all there in the night, I said, right, I said, now, about these rations, I said, I'll give you all your cards back. And I said, I've done the best I could for you. And this chap said, yes, well, I know. And he said, nothing. I said, well, it's just a bit of bad luck for you there, I said. So here you are, here's your rations. Marked up on your card, a full card. Somebody said, bloody hell, we've never had that before. I've been here such and such a time. He said, we've never had a full card yet. I said, well, you've got one this week, I said, and you'll get one next week, or at least, because I did appreciate that these quartermasters, or the blokes who set themselves up as quartermasters, they again were controlled by the people that supplied them. And all the way through the army system, there is black market going on in every quarter. So if each little person has got an empire of keeping so much back for themselves, it means that the people they hand on to don't always get what they're entitled to. And as it gets further down the line, so of course diminishes with everybody taking a little bit out. So I can appreciate that situation. But having found a friend and with this sergeant, of course my room always got the quota from then on. And I used to play mouth organ quite well, so I was always in great demand for entertainment. And to the degree that he said to me when I've been there some time, he said, best thing you can do, you know, Reg, he said, is come in with me. He said, I'll tell the major, he said, I can do with a bit of help, he said. Move in here, he said. He said, it's a cushy number, he said. I mean, he'd been there donkey's years sort of thing. I said, no, that's not for me. I said, I don't want to be stuck here. I said, anyway, Bruges, I said, there's nothing here. I said, you'll walk around the place in an hour. So, of course, that was my introduction to the barracks.